which composers have, they feel trust from the director. And I think generally it's what makes people do their best work.
Sound of Cinema with Matthew Sweet.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
This is Radio 3. It's midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Olivia Harrison is a prize-winning film producer and charity director. Last year, she published Came the Lightning, a poignant collection of 20 poems dedicated to her late husband, George Harrison of the Beatles. George died in November 2001 at the age of 58, and Olivia describes her poems as thoughts, feelings and words about life and death, but mostly love and our journey to the end. Olivia grew up in Los Angeles, and in her early 20s, she joined A&M Records. She first met George in 1974 and went on to help run his Dark Horse record label. They married 4 years later. Olivia has protected George's musical legacy since his death and continued the work of the Material World Foundation, the charity he founded 50 years ago. She's also worked with Martin Scorsese to create an acclaimed Emmy-winning documentary all about George. We're going to hear music, Olivia, by Bach, Ravi Shankar, as well as recordings from Mexico and Bulgaria. But first, Mozart.
Well, it was Ray Cooper who brought this piece of music to George. Ray Cooper, very well-known and loved percussionist who toured with Elton for decades. He brought a lot of music into our lives. And this was one that just traveled with us from the day he brought it, and I still listen to it.
What was George's reaction to classical music?
George loved all music, good music, but sometimes he would hear something that could have been the root of a popular song, you know, which many are, and that would always catch his ear. Warsaw Concerto and Brandenburg, he would hear them in songs. What was that? Go and find that. He had a lot of vinyl. He had a lot of 78 classicals, a stack of them, and I, to this day, don't know where they came from, but he must have heard them in his childhood.
Let's hear some of the Mozart, then. I mean, one thinks of Bach as being God, and then Beethoven the Holy Ghost, but Mozart is perhaps Jesus to many of us in the musical world.
Thank you.
This is on our jukebox.
Really?
Yes, this is number one on the jukebox. Number two is Emperor Concerto. And then the Nutcracker, in case little kitties come over. But then Little Richard and Elvis.
Well, we heard the second part of the Allegro from the Piano Concerto No. 23 in A major, played by Vladimir Ashkenazy with the Philharmonia Orchestra. Tell us about your early life, Olivia.
Well, I was born in Los Angeles. My grandparents came from Mexico. And I grew up listening to songs in Spanish and then hearing them later in English and saying, oh, I know that song. These songs became hits when non-Hispanic people recorded them. You know, Big Mama Thornton and Hound Dog, but Elvis is the one that had the hit. Same thing with the Hispanics. Those songs were recorded and popular with the Mexican community, but they weren't hits until, dare I say, a white person sang them. So, you know, I heard the song as a child, Aquellos Ojos Verdes, and suddenly I'm watching a movie after school, black and white movie, and there's Helen O'Connell with a big orchestra, and she's wearing a gown, and her hair is up, and she's singing Those Green Eyes. But she's singing it in a way that I could never forget, because she was those cool and limpid green eyes. No, very sort of strangled version, but to me, Aquellos Ojos Verdes. I heard that by Trio Los Panchos, who are famous from North America all the way down to Tierra del Fuego. I know this because every time I'd get in a car, I would play Trio Los Panchos, and the drivers would always know it. Ah, they were the ones. But it wasn't until Edie Gourmet became a lead singer with them and sang in English that these songs became popular.
Aquellos ojos verdes de mirada serena dejaron en mi alma eterna sed de amar, anhelos de caricias, de besos y ternuras, de todas las dulzuras que sabían brindar. Aquellos ojos verdes, serenos como un lago, en cuyas quietas aguas un día me miré. No saben la tristeza que a mi alma le dejaron aquellos ojos verdes que yo nunca besaré. No saben la tristeza que a mi alma le dejaron aquellos ojos verdes que yo nunca besaré.
Those Green Eyes, written by, and you can tell me,
Adolfo Utrera y Nilo Menéndez.
But performed there by the Trio Los Panchos.
Yeah, Trio Los Panchos really well known in the Americas, and still are, because as the original members died, others took their places, and they still carry on as Trio Los Panchos. I used to watch Mexican movies. I think living in England, I missed that. And I would call George in, put it on pause when I knew a song was coming on. They were all musicals. And he would pick up a guitar and play along with it. And he loved the chords, and he picked up on some of those chords. So one day I just took all the movies and cut out the songs, because I knew he would never watch all the movies. And then he sort of got back at me by taking all the George Formby songs from the George Formby movies and making a collection of those. So, you know, we had fun. We watched a lot of musicals.
Your father worked as a dry cleaner. Your mum was a seamstress. And you've brought with you a rather rare recording of him singing, haven't you?
I found these acetates a while back. In fact, George recorded my father in the studio years later, but my father actually sang with his brothers. They used to record on a Sunday. My dad played guitar, and I'm sure he was more of a musician in his heart, but he worked very hard to keep a roof over our head.
Let's have just a minute from the 1938 acetate. What is he singing?
A song called Nosotros, which was a very popular song. It still is. It's been covered by Jose Feliciano. And when Ry Cooter went to Cuba with Buena Vista Social Club, they recorded it. So this song has been around a long time. This is 1938.
Necesito hablarte y a ti lo haré. Nosotros que fuimos tan sinceros que desde que nos vimos amando no cesamos. Nosotros que del amor hicimos un sol maravilloso como vino. Nosotros, ¿cuántos debemos separarnos? No me preguntes ya.
Nosotros, played by Ezequiel Arias. It has a wonderful South American stroke Spanish passion to it, doesn't it?
Yes, I thought he had a lovely voice.
Did he get on well with George?
Oh, they were best pals.
It's wonderful the way that love of music binds people together, even if they're not professional musicians.
Absolutely. And George is very generous. He had my mother playing ukulele. He'd get her playing one string, and then he'd play all around it. He was very encouraging.
So he would riff around a kind
of... absolutely. Yeah. He did this with children and grown-ups. He'd say, well, I can't play this. He'd say, no, just do this. Just do this one thing. And then he'd create this joyful moment for... You know, music was his language.
Did you learn a musical instrument when you were young?
I didn't when I was young. A little bit later, I used to do this very simplified piano. It was dreadful, but I would play Claire de Lune, and George would say, wow, you're like a real player now. No, I'm not. That's ridiculous. No, no. He loved it, any attempt.
You started working for A&M Records in Los Angeles. How did you come to go into the music industry?
A fluke, really. Really, I was just driving by A&M one day and saw a crowd of young people and thought, that looks interesting. I'd just come back from Europe. I thought, I need a job. So I just went in. I ended up working for Jerry Moss, one of the owners of the company. And George's label, a couple of years later, came to A&M Records to be distributed.
You were his second wife after he divorced Patty Boyd in 1977. And I think he wanted you to come to the UK and live with him at Friar Park. Did that present something of a challenge to you, or were you so in love that it was very easy?
It was just a natural move, really. We were apart only a couple of weeks and I came over.
I mean, it's so different to your background, you know, that huge Victorian pile near Henley.
I know, but George was a very natural, normal person, grounded, you know, literally, because the root of George's geo is of the earth. He played things down, you know, his fame, his surroundings. He really came from a solid family. As you know, in Liverpool, when he came to my parents' house the first time, I was saying to him, now, you know, it's just a little house. And he came in and he said, you must be kidding. This is like a mansion compared to where I lived.
And his sort of compositional flower, if you like, took a little bit longer to bud than Paul and John, didn't it? But when it did, it was very powerful.
Yeah, it was all brewing in there probably from a very young age. John said once about George, there was nothing mysterious about George, but the mystery in him was immense.
Then, of course, there was this mutual interest in Eastern mysticism, because you'd studied meditation a bit before you met him, hadn't you, Olivia?
I had. I'm sure that was part of the attraction, especially coming out of the Beatles and years of turmoil, really. He had a focus. He had a laser focus. He wanted some clarity to take the inner journey, and that's what I was on.
Indian classical music next, which became a mutual love.
Yes, yes it did.
But of course it's a very complicated art form, isn't it? I mean, you can't just pick up a sitar and play Indian music.
No, you know, but it's also elevating. George said the first time he heard a piece of music, it was an orchestral piece. Ravi Shankar composed something for All India Radio in the 50s. He said it had a divinity to it, and that changed his ear. And he had kind of big ears. It was funny, but he could hear things. Maybe other people didn't hear, but it wasn't a dalliance. It was really serious to him. And he tried to incorporate some of those flavors into Western music. And of course he did, just played sitar as he would have played a guitar in Norwegian wood. But then it became more sophisticated. And it's not an easy thing to do, to play an Indian rhythmic cycle in a Western 4-4.
And this piece that we're going to hear?
This is a stunning album called Call of the Valley. And I knew these musicians. Ravi Shankar brought them together. They were his students, really grew to become the finest exponents of their instruments in India. Shiv Kumar Sharma on the santur, Hari Prasad Charesia on flute bansuri, which is a big bamboo flute, or a tiny little bamboo piccolo. This music to me is intoxicating. Brij Bhujangkabra played slide guitar on his lap.
Fascinating, too, that there's a fine tabla player, because the tabla, which makes that wonderfully watery percussion sound, is essential in Indian music, isn't it?
It's funny you say that, that it is watery. George told me a story that when Ravi Shankar and Alaraka went to Russia, they played for Khrushchev, and he thought there was a trick inside that tabla and made him take off the skins to look inside, because he was sure there was something else in there.
Thank you. of the Valley, an album released in 1968. Like so many ragas, it's allied to the passage of time, and in this case, a day in the life of a shepherd.
I think this is one of the first pieces I heard. It also was on a jukebox when I came to Friarbark in 1974.
Later on in life, George worked on a series of Indian chants with Ravi Shankar.
Ravi helped him, nursed him, taught him how to walk in that sense. And I found, not so long ago, a cassette, and it said, First Sitar Lesson. And it was Ravi singing a little tune and then showing George a stroke, just the stroke, because you had the downstroke and the upstroke. And it just shows his patience and focus and humility. You just hear the seriousness of it. It's like, I'm starting from the beginning. He said, just learning how to sit and wearing that misra on your finger, that pick, that he said, was just like this little thing biting your finger. So he immersed himself in Indian classical music, and he wanted to take his friends with him, trying to get them to feel the passion that he felt, whether they wanted to or not. But he said there was nothing better than to wake up in the morning and hear that flute floating up the stairs to his bedroom. And he'd come down and they'd all be rehearsing. Ravi was composing.
Your recent book of poetry, Came the Lightning, gives us an insight into your life together. Very touchingly, I think. Beautiful photographs and drawings scattered throughout. What made you pick the form of poetry?
It chose me. I had a neurological incident, an amnesia episode. And a neurologist friend of mine called me and said, your brain has had an assault. It needs a massage. You should read poetry for the next 3 days. And I did. And I wanted to remember what I was seeing in those days. And so I started to write things down, but it came out in this poetic form and in this rhyming verse.
Well, I think we should hear one of the poems. And the one I'd like you to read, if you'd be happy to, is Her or Me, which is the competition, you could say, between one sort of lady and another.
Yes, Her or Me. Three words of love, a kiss on the head, a hint of your smile, so easily led by diminished chords and open-tuned strings, Sanskrit mantras, om, hrim, klim. My nervous whistle became the first note, soon to be known as a song that he wrote. Add the flick of a butter knife ringing a glass, cut crystal rhythms and spoon castanets. A silent guitar, sometimes ignored, then caressed and strummed, he fell in love once more. Round and curvaceous, like a woman, you see, I wondered if he loved her much more than me.
I imagine that rather than feeling eclipsed by his music, you became part of a shared passion.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we sang to each other, we played songs for each other, and we were immersed in music the whole time.
I mentioned earlier that classical music is partially defined by a holy trinity of Mozart. We've already knocked off the list, Beethoven. But, of course, God is Bach, and that's where we're turning next, isn't it?
That's funny. I was just on holiday. A friend of mine had just come from a songwriting camp. We were talking, there's so much talent. There's so many incredibly talented people whose songs never get heard. And he said, yeah, well, look at Bach. He wrote these Brandenburg concertos and a letter. He said the letter that he sent to Christian Ludwig, the Margrave of Brandenburg, the younger brother of King Frederick. He says, I noticed that your highness took some pleasure in the little talents which heaven has given me for music. And so humble. And he writes these, never acknowledged, and it takes another 100 years for them to be performed.
Well, let's hear the first movement of Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 2 in F major.
Thank you.
The first movement of the Brandenburg Concerto No. 2 in F major by Bach, performed by the Academy of Ancient Music and conducted by Christopher Hogwood.
It's okay, Michael. I have one question for you. Why is Bach God?
I think it's because he manages the most perfect marriage of the cerebral and the heart. In other words, the actual technique of the music, which on its own could be dry, but with a kind of passion that makes it totally human.
And do you think Mozart was more technical than he was heart?
Not more technical, but perhaps had a lighter touch, in a sense.
George and Paul actually used to play this Bach fugue that was sort of a party piece. I asked Paul the other day, and he played it for me. That was always sweet when they played that.
You're listening to Private Passions on BBC Radio 3 with me, Michael Barclay, and my guest today, the film producer and writer, Olivia Harrison. Were you ever around when the first idea for a song came to George? Did he suddenly light up?
I was around. I remember one especially, and it was raining. And I can hear him on the cassette, you know, saying, "Hey, Liv, would you get me a pencil?" I could tell when he was ready to write a song because he would drift off. Something was coming through him and he'd sort of stare off, and then you knew something was coming because he'd do this. And he'd tear a piece of paper off, scribble a note, stick it in his pocket.
Tell us a little bit about life at Friar Park. All kinds of people would visit there, wouldn't they?
Yes. In fact, we had a few musical concerts there. Ravi Shankar brought his students. We set up a stage and set up chairs. And we also had Trio Bulgarka perform, which really blew the roof off. It was so different. And as they were leaving the porch, which is stone and marble, and it has a great sound in there, and guys often went in there and did hand claps and things.
Because you had a studio in the house.
There's a studio and it has patch cords into almost every room, so you could perform on the landing or in one room or another. That had different ambience, different acoustics. Anyway, they stopped at the front door, and he sang with them, and it was like heaven for him.
Well, here are the Trio Bulgarka, performing as part of the Bulgarian State Radio and Television Female Vocal Choir, the song Kalimanku Denku, or The Evening Gathering. What an extraordinary sound, Olivia Harrison.
I'm just so moved by this track and their harmonies. They're so unusual to our ears. On the liner notes, it said, you know, these sounds cannot be taught. There are hundreds of years of oppression. George was very sympathetic to that. It's really ancient harmonies here.
Some of the poems in your collection deal with very difficult and painful memories. For example, there's one, He Never Hurt No One, about the night when you received the phone call to say that John Lennon had died. And you describe that call at an hour you know is bad news. What did you feel when you heard that news?
Disbelief. But I somehow moved past that very quickly to the thought, how am I going to say this? Not something I would wish on anyone. I mean, George obviously knew something was wrong. I just said it was one of your mates. And he said, Ringo? I said, no, it's John. He didn't believe it, really. He said, how do they know? No, it can't be. How do they know? Well, what are we supposed to do? Do we get up? What do we do? It's pretty devastating.
It's extraordinary that sometimes people of peace end up being at the wrong end of violence.
Yeah.
And, of course, you experienced this, you and George.
Who knows? I think there are so many sayings, you know, when the elephant walks, the dogs bark. Or you think of the lightness and dark and how they go together. And perhaps someone trying to express that light attracts that. George used to say, when John died, it's like somebody ripped the pages of that chapter out and put something else in. The story wasn't going like that. And it changes you for sure.
Your poem, Heroic Couple, describes the night an intruder broke into your house and attacked both you and George with a knife. Because you actually had to react quite violently. I mean, otherwise things might have been much worse.
Yes, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. I think in the brutality of that knife attack was also the fact that you have to renounce what you believe and fight back. And that is a moment. Am I a pacifist? Could I harm someone? You think never. And then suddenly you have to lay down that mantle. You have to put it aside. And that's brutal. You know, Martin Scorsese made a movie called Silence, which was about apostasy. It was about priests that had to renounce their belief. And I spoke to him about it because I said, you know, it's one thing when you're thinking about it, can I do this? But it's another thing when you don't have time to think about it. You're experiencing it in that real time. Oh, no, now I have to hurt someone.
Survival takes over.
Love, survival, and Dharma. Hmm. Actually, it was Martin Scorsese sent me an article quoting Mahatma Gandhi, saying, violence is better than cowardice when it needs to be performed. And I thought, wow, that's an interesting statement. If you see somebody's going to hurt someone else and you don't stop them, that's cowardice. And in fact, here's a story that pertains to that night of the heroic couple. George had notes in a pocket right over his heart, and he had them folded. And that is what saved him. So you could say gardening notes and lyrics, you know, his passions really saved his life.
George, to move on to another tragic event, passed away from lung cancer in November of 2001. And you very movingly describe those final days in Came the Lightning. And in one of your poems, Another Spring, the pain of that loss, the idea of wanting another spring is very powerful.
Well, Beth Chatto, who is a beloved landscape architect and gardener here in England.
Yeah, wonderful gardener.
Wonderful. She came over and looked at what we were doing. She said, oh, you do need help, and gave us some advice. But she said, you know, George, we only have so many springs to get it right. Yeah. And we talked about it that night. Wow, it suddenly changed everything. And we were young, and still we started to realize she's right. So when George was diagnosed and going to have some treatment, why should I do this? And I just said, another spring.
After his death, Ravi Shankar composed a piece of music as a tribute to George. And that's what you've chosen next. And it actually features at the end Eric Clapton joining in the Indian players.
Ravi wrote this piece of music, and I thought it was so ironic that George would have to die for this piece to manifest, because really it was an orchestral piece as the first one he'd heard on All India Radio by Ravi. He was always trying to reproduce that, but now it's written about George. And all of his friends played, and this wonderful array of Western musicians, the Indian classical, different time.
I was fascinated because I watched a video of this, and Anushka Shankar was conducting a beat that I'd never seen before.
She's doing the Western beat over here, and she said, I had to use bend backwards, twitch my ears to give the flute and the tabla and somebody else cues, because they were in different time signatures. And that was Ravi's genius. And Eric, I think it was just the night before, I said, you know, Ravi wants you to do a piece at the end. He said, I can't. I've learned all these other songs, and I don't think I can do it. He had one night to sort of learn or practice something, and it's so beautiful.
So this is the final part of Arpan, or Offering.
That's really genius, Eric, playing that. And the fact that he could immerse himself in all those bends and all those notes and that rhythm to just open up and play as he did. I've never heard him play like that before. And yet it's still bluesy, and that's what George loved about Indian music. He said it was like the blues. I know I can say this. He would probably think, oh, it's worth it to die just to get Eric to play that. Seriously, you know, and Robbie used to call George J. Raj, a Hare, Harrison, you know, like son of Harry, son of Hari. So he used to say J. Raj, and that's where that came from.
The final part of Arpan, or Offering, by Ravi Shankar, performed at the Concert for George in 2002 and conducted by Anushka Shankar.
She's really incredible. She was so young, and we used to watch her having a lesson with Ravi, and George said, poor Anushka, at least I could go home.
George had a parallel career in the 70s and 80s as a film producer, didn't he? Financing lots of films, including, famously, The Life of Brian. I think he even put Friar Park up as a kind of collateral to get that done. I wonder what you made of that.
Yeah, I didn't really know till after the fact. I'm not even sure he did. Luckily, it worked out.
And film restoration is part of the work that your charity, the Material World Foundation, undertakes. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Having worked with Martin Scorsese on the Living in the Material World documentary on George, I came to know how passionate he was about film restoration. And I feel really privileged that we could help him restore these films, some of his favorites, some of my favorites, mine being some Mexican films, Enamorada, El, a Buñuel film, Los Olvidados, very important Mexican films, but also Powell and Pressburger, I Know Where I'm Going, Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, and we've done three very early Charlie Chaplin films, as well as a few others.
You haven't actually selected any music by George in this program, but his spirit has been throughout everything. So do you have a favorite track by him?
Yes. I mean, I love Run of the Mill. And he liked that song, too. And he was happy that I liked that song. It's just a little reminder. Everyone has choice when to and not to raise their voices. It's you that decides. You know, how high will you leap? Will you make enough for you to reap it? Only you'll arrive at your own made end with no one but yourself to be offended. It's you that decides. And it's really about how we live our lives. We have to account for what we do, what we say.
And what we don't do.
Yeah, and what we don't do.
We're going to finish with a piece of guitar music that unites you both.
Well, it's the craziest coincidence that our mothers were both named Louise and had the same favorite song called Maria Elena, very popular, oddly enough, by Los Indios Trabajadores back in the 60s. I don't know how George's mother heard it. In California, you know, that would not be a surprise. But the fact that she had that album and my mother had this album in these latitudes so far apart, and yet we had this song that sort of bound us all together, our families together.
Well, it only remains for me to say thank you very much, Olivia, for joining us for Private Passions.
Thank you so much for a beautiful morning.
Maria Elena, performed by Los Indios Tabajaras, written by Lorenzo Barsalata, the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest today on Private Passions, the film producer and writer Olivia Harrison. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio, BBC Sounds and on most smart speakers, just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by me, Jane Royce. Rishi Sunak is at the Conservative Party conference in Manchester, where he's refused to commit to cutting taxes, despite pressure from some in his party. Earlier, the Levelling Up Secretary, Michael Gove, called for taxes to be lowered ahead of the general election expected next year. The Prime Minister would also not confirm whether the HS2 high-speed rail line would ever reach Manchester. The multi-billion pound project, originally planned to link London, Birmingham and the north of England, has been plagued by delays and overspends. The Home Office says a further 537 migrants arrived in the UK on small boats intercepted in the English Channel yesterday. The total since the start of the year now stands at 24,830. The Turkish government says two people have attempted to carry out a bomb attack in front of police headquarters near the Parliament building in Ankara. Officials say one of the attackers blew himself up and the other was killed by police. A UN team's arrived in Nagorno-Karabakh to assess humanitarian needs after the region was recaptured by Azerbaijan. The vast majority of its ethnic Armenian residents, more than 100,000, have fled to neighbouring Armenia over the past few days. A pro-Russian party promising to stop sending military aid to Ukraine has emerged as the largest in yesterday's parliamentary election in Slovakia. The populist Smear Party won 22% of the vote and its disgraced leader Robert Fico could be on track to become prime minister for the fourth time. He was forced to resign in 2018 after the murder of a journalist who'd uncovered links between his party and organised crime. New rules aimed at easing post-Brexit trade between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK have come into force. The first lorries have gone through the red and green lane system at Belfast Harbour after arriving from Scotland. Under the new system, trusted traders can use green lanes to reduce checks on goods that are destined for Northern Ireland and not for the Irish Republic. And today's weather, showers in Wales and Northern England will ease off in the evening. It'll be dry elsewhere, with lots of sunshine in Scotland and Northern Ireland. And that's the BBC News and weather. It's 2 minutes past one.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical and magical music. Join the BBC Philharmonic and me, Jess Gillam, for the UK premiere of Anna Klein's folklore-inspired saxophone concerto. A fairy tale world from Ravel. And a mythical land from Elgar. Radio 3 in concert, fairy tale and folklore, live from